Good evening, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 31st in the year 2000. Tonight, in our fireside room, we are pleased to have as our presenter, Cynthia Molibita, who is continuing her series on the effects of economic globalization. Tonight's presentation is entitled Luther's Economic Ethics. Let's listen in.
Series of five sessions that hold in light of each other two seemingly distant things. And one of those is the moral, spiritual crises entailed in economic globalization today. And the other thing that we hold in light of that is a particular faith claim, and that is the claim that God lives in human beings and all of creation. We've been exploring those two realities, and we have been doing so in a particular way. When I speak of the moral spiritual crises entailed in globalization, I refer, and this is a bit of review for those of you who have been here before, but I'll try to do it as succinctly as I can. I'm talking about a particular contradiction with which we live that is life-defining for us. And that contradiction is this. We, followers of Jesus Christ, are a people called to love neighbor. Our life work, our purpose for being, is to receive the love of God, to love God, and to love neighbor, self, and the world. This is why we are here. And I dare say that everyone in this room longs to follow that calling. When we hear Jesus say that the whole law and the commandment is summed up in this, love thy neighbor as thyself, we long to live that way. And yet, in a very tragic and stark, but sometimes hidden contrast, we live as participants in global economic arrangements that fundamentally exploit neighbors in terrible ways and exploit the very earth itself. So here we are, stuck with the call to love neighbor, the longing to love neighbor, and finding ourselves locked into economic practices that render death for many neighbors and for many aspects of Earth. And I know that that is a startling claim, that the economic structure that is shaping the global economy, that the ways of life in which we live economically are dangerous and deadly. And I haven't been presenting a bunch of data to support that claim, but I have been presenting the voices of a few people who make that claim. And I will share with you a couple of those voices. But first, let me say that the journey that we are on in these sessions, the journey to dig deeply into, to dare to look at the consequences of economic globalization, is a journey that demands a great deal of courage. It's a journey that wanders through the terrain of despair. Welcome. Wanders through the terrain of hopelessness and finally into the terrain of hope and power to make a difference in this setting. We journey, as I said, into the realities of globalization. We also are journeying into the lives of some of our faith forebearers, our ancestors. And I have chosen particular faith forebearers who, it seems to me, exhibited a tremendous amount of power, moral, spiritual power, to follow the call to love. In spite of the fact that tremendous systems of domination and exploitation were set up and that they had to defy. We've glanced at a number of figures in church history, hearing their voices. We've glanced at a second century figure, at some medieval women. We are also looking more thoroughly than anything else at Luther and the ways in which a particular faith claim that he made was a source of moral power, and that is the claim that God lives in creation. What we've been doing is focusing on two questions, and I've listed those questions here. And we'll look at those, and then I will bring us into a very, very brief look at some of the voices that claim that the globalizing economy is deadly in many ways. The first question is this. If indeed the prevailing model of globalization brutalizes the poor and jeopardizes Earth's regenerative capacities, Earth's capacity to sustain life, then why do we acquiesce to that model without standing up and declaring it an affront to our faith? Why do we go along with it? The second question is this. Where in our Christian faith traditions are we offered hope and the moral spiritual power to resist, to revision, and to rebuild economic ways that nurture communities and the vast earth community according to justice and compassion for generations to come? Those are the two focal points of our inquiry in these five sessions. In the first session, we did a kind of introduction to economic globalization. In the second, we looked at some of the ideological factors, the belief systems to which we cling almost unknowingly that contribute to our acquiescence. In the third session yesterday, what did we do yesterday? Oh, we looked at the claim that God lives in creation. We looked at this painting. We looked at what happens to us and our power to live justly if we believe that we are body of Christ, that Christ dwells in us and the rest of the earth. So today we're stepping more deeply into Martin Luther, and we're turning to Luther with some questions. But before we get to today, let me take a brief rewind, and I do this because it's pertinent to the look at Luther, a brief rewind into day one. And in day one, in looking at kind of an introduction to the dynamics at play in globalization, I identified five defining trends, five of the defining trends of economic globalization today. And they're listed here.
Whoa.
And we look at them again today because they are interesting to note in light of Martin Luther's economic norms. The first of these trends is probably the easiest to just grasp at face value, and that is a rapid increase in the movement of goods and services and capital across international borders. Is that fairly self-explanatory? Increased trade and investment. The second trend is what I call the subordination of democratic political power to unaccountable economic players. And by that I mean that increasingly bilateral and multilateral treaties between nations and between many nations are being established that take away the power of governments to regulate corporate activity within their terrain. Take away the power of city governments, state and provincial governments, and federal governments, so that democratic political power, what we claim to have in our governments, becomes subordinated to the will and the actions of economic players that are not accountable to the public. As an example of that, and I want to give just an example that helps to make it clear, the example I will give, well, first of all, let me take a step backwards. One manifestation of those treaties that was international in focus was the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, that was being negotiated by the 29 most industrialized nations for about 6 years in the late 90s. Somewhat in secret, I have a letter from about 32 US Congress people that didn't know about it, and a letter really protesting the fact that this was being negotiated without the knowledge of Congress. The treaty established had about 7 clauses that really ripped from governments the legal power to regulate corporate activity. An example of what, and that treaty was discovered by French and Canadians, basically, who were appalled by it and made it public, using the internet in particular. The French were tremendously upset because of the cultural implications for French culture of highly unregulated corporate U.S. activity in France. And public protests throughout the world curtailed the implementation of that treaty, but it's cropping up in other places. And one of those places is the WTO, which was one of the big elements of the protests against the WTO. But that's background. An example of the implications of this kind of treaty is, do all of you remember the efforts to boycott around South Africa to stop apartheid in South Africa? All of that boycotting would have been illegal under this treaty. If this treaty had been in place that time, the church's efforts worldwide to boycott around South Africa would have been illegal. Another example is, and I think we brought this up earlier, a similar clause that's in that treaty, that is also in another treaty between Canada and the United States and Mexico, enabled the Exxon Corporation to sue Canada for banning the transport of a toxic material across the Canadian lands. Exxon was able to sue Canada for that ban because under the clause that says that a country can't limit the profits of the corporation. And Exxon won. Canada had to pay a lot of money. But another example that we haven't talked about, do you all remember the boycott against Nestle products? Nestle was, so everyone's familiar with that. A powerful boycott. I spent 2 years as a missionary in Honduras, and I know the deadly nature of selling infant formula to women who can't have boiled water. It makes babies die. So that was a powerful boycott on behalf of poor, illiterate women and their children. Guatemala passed rules alongside of that boycott activity, banning the advertising of infant formula through pictures that showed healthy babies being fed by formulas and unhealthy babies being fed by mother's breasts. That was a way that the Guatemalan government helped to promote the health of babies. Am I making sense, or should I be more explicit? So Guatemala passed laws protecting illiterate women from being sucked into buying infant formula. Now, under the new rulings that the WTO was establishing, the Gerber Company said that Guatemala, with that rule, was expropriating its profits, limiting its profits, limiting its ability to sell infant formula in Guatemala. Guatemala, afraid of the legal suits that would be entailed in trying to fight the Gerber Corporation on that, backed down. And now infant formula is advertised by Gerber in Guatemala with big billboards showing healthy, robust babies being fed with infant formula. Do you follow the gist of that? That's the capacity of the Guatemalan government to regulate the activity of the Gerber Corporation in its lands is limited by that treaty. So that's an example of number two. And there's a reason that I'm bringing that up now. Number three, the third trend, is simply that an increasing portion of the world's economies, largest economies, are corporations. 51 of the 100 largest economies in the world are corporations. Corporations are not accountable to a democratic public. Therefore, economic decisions made by corporations are not accountable to the body politic. And that is linked to the subordination of democratic power to economic players. The fourth trend is the privatization of public goods and services. And I think we all have seen that happening in our own country. Increasing privatization, say, of utilities. Someone brought up utilities in certain ways. Privatization of prisons. But an example that I will give of that, just to make it real, is the privatization of water. Water is becoming one of the world's important and scarce and to be contested resources. Last year, a British corporation bought the water supply surrounding the city of Cochabamba in South America, raised the water prices by 300%. Have we talked about that already in this series? Can you imagine? Water means life for poor peasant people. When you are a South American, or my experience is Central American, peasant person, clean water means life or death for your kids. Dirty water means they get horrible diarrhea and are in threat of their lives. To have water raised by 300% if you are a subsistence level peasant means you can't buy water. So the water was privatized, bought by a foreign company to be bottled elsewhere, perhaps in China, and sold to people who can pay for it. So I give you that as there were riots all around Cochabamba, much protest, and I can't tell you the outcome of that. But that's an example of what I mean by privatization. What happens if water becomes a commodity that can be purchased by those with money and taken from lands of those who don't have money? The fifth is the commodification of money, and by that I mean increasingly money is something you buy and sell rather than that you use to buy and sell. We purchase in speculative investment and currency speculation, we buy and sell money. And the implication is that money can go into a country fast and come out of a country fast, and the economy falls. And this we saw in Southeast Asia, and we see the implications on people's lives there. So I'm naming that, and you'll probably see why, as five defining trends in economic globalization today. Allow me to read maybe two brief voices that speak to the dangers of this model of economic life. Sue, you have your hand raised.
Well, this just puzzles me. Going back to Cochabamba, a corporation knows that they are purposely killing people, the mindset of their CEOs and the people that run the country, what is going on? I mean, I believe that people are inherently good, but what would make them buy into knowing that they are creating this evil? I don't get this. It just boggles my mind that they would do this purposely. Do they think they're doing something else and this is the result? The end result of...
I can't answer your question, Sue. It is a terribly important question, and I don't know the answer. I mean, the best case scenario would be that they don't know what it means to not be able to afford water, but that's hard to believe. But it is mind-boggling. Why would a corporation send toxic wastes to poor countries and bury them there? You know, you wonder that also. Why would a corporation, you know, another example of this is the subordination of democratic political power. Why would a corporation go in and mine the lands of the Philippines in certain areas so badly that the forests and the mountains can no longer sustain human life and the tribal peoples die? You ask why. There's a tribe of indigenous people in South America, that have threatened mass suicide if Exxon is allowed into their land. So why, I don't know. Yes.
The Orthodox would speak of all of this in the in talking about spiritual warfare and lies and deception and self-deception and sometimes just deliberate wanting to gain a profit. But it would be in more of a cosmic kind of framework.
The battle between good and evil, is that
right.
What you're talking about?
And personified good and evil, too.
Well, I appreciate that comment.
I know that this isn't the kind of place where you put that. But.
Well, no, it is. It's a very timely place. On the one hand, I really hesitate to personify evil in certain people. I mean, I think we must do that with great caution.
I didn't mean people.
Yeah.
I mean that there's a personal element
to
evil that just as this just God is personal.
Okay.
Created fallen beings.
And so it's a manifestation of evil that human beings would make these kinds of decisions.
Right, and temptations and deceit, I mean, lies. It's just the whole package. And appealing to people's greed and, that would be the underlying structure.
Well, you will notice that in the whole discussion, I no longer, this would be considered a moral issue, an issue of our moral lives. I no longer use that word, and I'm an ethicist. My field is the moral life. I always now use moral spiritual, because what started me on this whole pursuit in terms of looking at faith in relationship to this is the sense that this is a spiritual, this is not only a material crisis facing the humankind, it's a spiritual crisis. That something is wrong in the relationship between people and their God if we make these kinds of decisions or allow them to be made under our noses. So I do think that it is a manifestation of a deep and profound spiritual problem. And I think that that is why we turn not only to understand the sociological and political dimensions, but the spiritual dimensions of it. Roger.
I think we tend to rationalize. Mm-hmm. And an example, if you take history, the Spaniards, when they invaded the New World, uh-huh. these were heathens. These were uh-huh. they weren't really people. Uh-huh. We look at the people today, and what do we call third world?
Uh-huh.
They're below us. They're not equal. Mm. So you look at them as inferior.
Well, I do think that also is a good point. And we talked in the second session about the belief systems that enable this kind of thing. And I do think one of those belief systems has to do with who we are, that somehow we are people who, the belief that we are driven by economic self-interest and self-gain, which is a fundamental axiom of the economic theory undergirding all of this, shapes people in that way. What we do shapes us. And so maybe we, Western humanity, are shaping our children and ourselves into people who will agree with unlimited economic gain at the cost of other people. Let's go on, but let us hold that question that you raised, Sue, and that others have responded to in our hearts and minds as we do go on. I won't read many voices here. I will read one. And I don't think we've heard this voice this week. It is the voice of a Methodist bishop from Mozambique named Bernardino Mandlate. And he's speaking about economic life in the North, the global North, the North Atlantic, Europe, and America. He says, in the global North, what I want has replaced what I need. What I want is a list which increases due to market forces. I am prepared to sacrifice millions around the world to ensure that I live with what I want. Africans suffer and starve so that the living standards in the global North can be maintained and improved. Millions of African children die of malnutrition to ensure that children of the North can overeat. Africa is forced to drain its major resources to service the international debt. This debt is full of blood. He's specifically talking about the debt that the African nations owe to U.S. and other industrialized nations and the IMF and World Bank. And he is a warrior against the debt. That's how he identifies himself. And the debt, the international debt, is part of this whole global economic system. It's one that we have the chance as church people to impact, because we know there are movements in all of our churches called the Jubilee Movement to cancel the third world debt, so that rather than spending their money to repay an ancient debt, they can feed their kids and provide health care and education. That voice is just one that speaks to the impact of the globalizing economy. The next that I will read, and the last, speaks to this issue of, are our democratic processes threatened by this form of globalization? And this is the voice of David Rockefeller, who was president and CEO of Chase Manhattan Bank in 1994. It's at an event that was hosted by President Clinton to commemorate the first Summit of the Americas. Two journalists inquired of Rockefeller, and now I quote, "Mr. Rockefeller, you were present in the 1960s during President Kennedy's Alliance for Progress Summit with the leaders of Latin America. Can you tell us what, if anything, has changed since then?" "Well," Rockefeller replies, "back then, business leaders like myself were more or less sitting on the sidelines watching the negotiations unfold. But now we're sitting in the driver's seat, writing many of the documents ourselves." Now, unquote. The MAI that I told you about, the treaty that was being negotiated by government officials that would hand over so much power to corporations, the main advisors in that treaty were corporate officials and corporate, not I don't say corporate, I mean global corporation, large corporation officials and lawyers. So you see, international public policy documents being written to provide powers to corporate and finance entities, I am suggesting is a threat to democracy and warrants the attention of government officials. Okay. We could ask questions and talk on and on about this subject, and we're going to move along here. And we'll move on because it's horrific to wallow in the mires of it all and the complexity of it all and the sinister nature of it all. And it's very important to claim and name the fact that we are people with the power to make a difference. And that part of that power is grounded in the fact that we are beloved by God and that we are the presence of God is breathed into us. And we have many, many alternatives to this kind of economic life on the table that are being thought of and developed by people around the world, including our own state, our own cities. We need to look at them and investigate them. We also need to look theologically. What theological resources are there for us to think differently about what on earth it means to be involved in economic activity? What is the purpose of buying and selling things? On what grounds and for what reason do we do that? One of our faith ancestors, particularly pertinent to those of us who are Lutheran, is Martin Luther. And as I, some long time ago now, began to dig into Martin Luther, I realized that he provides fascinating and profound economic alternatives that were radical in his day and age. To begin with, we need to look at his context, at least briefly. And let me read you very briefly a paragraph from something else I've written about the context. I'm actually using quotes from many different people, and I can tell you who they are if you need to know. Luther's was a time of economic revolution, gradually transforming Germany from a nation of peasant agriculturalists into a society with at least the beginnings of a capitalist economy. Consequences included high prices, growing disparity of wealth, and increasing poverty, especially of those with small or fixed incomes. The poor were a cheap labor pool for an expanding profit economy. Some similarities, I think, to today. Poverty was a growing social problem that the medieval tradition of almsgiving and personal charity was incapable of addressing. Increasingly, large-scale international trade required capital which sought profitable investment, feeding capitalist economies and financial contracts. According to one of Luther's translators in Luther's works, I quote, "Luther's great concern was for justice and equity in the economic sphere." I was raised a Lutheran, and I didn't know that that was one of Luther's great concerns, and it's been fascinating to me to find out that it is. Luther wrote three major treatises on economic life. One of them is not translated into English in Luther's works. Two of them are. He also addresses economic life in many, many other places, the Small Catechism, the Large Catechism, in the comments on the Ten Commandments, and on the Creed and the Lord's Prayer. They're fraught with statements about economic life. One of his treatises, written in 1524, is called Trade and Usury, and it illustrates particular norms that Luther establishes for economic life. And I'd like to share with you those four norms and think about them in light of what we've said about the globalizing economy and the five defining trends. The first of his norms is this: because selling is an act toward neighbor, its goal should not be profit, but rather, quote unquote, an adequate living and serving the needs of the other. So there he establishes the goal of economic life. It's an adequate living for oneself and family and serving the needs of the other. Secondly, Luther argues frequently on purely theological grounds that economic activity ought be subject to political constraints. For example, he says, selling ought not be an act that is entirely within your own power and discretion. Civil authorities, government, ought establish quote-unquote rules and regulations, including ceilings on prices. A third of his norms is that trade in ostentatious items rather than useful items ought not be permitted. That's kind of fascinating when we think about how much of our economic life revolves around the buying and selling of ostentatious or luxury items. And the fourth is this. He establishes particular norms for Christian people regarding exchanging goods, buying and selling. And he says one is this. One of his rules is this. In buying and selling, adhere to firm rules. One is these. One is this. No selling at a price as high as the market would bear. Now, isn't that fascinating? Let's think about that. Let me say one other thing before we think about the connections between those and today. Luther also admonishes preachers, specifically, quote-unquote, admonishes preachers regarding their obligation in the face of economic practices that exploit the vulnerable. He says pastors are in the pulpit to preach, that is, speak the living Christ. For Luther, preaching is not giving your opinion, it is speaking the living Christ. The preached word is the living Christ spoken. Pastors are to preach, in preaching are to, quote, unmask hidden injustice, opening the eyes of civil authorities for their mandate to establish justice. He goes so far as to admonish clergy, and I could read some of these quotes, they're fiery quotes, to withhold the sacrament from a usurer, that is someone who charges interest, and not even bury him with Christians. Very fiery, fiery quotes about this. He renders specific judgments. He renders a judgment against charging a higher price for goods sold on credit, against raising prices when supply is low, against buying out the entire supply of a commodity and then raising the price. Now, these are standard practices of economic life today, of speculative, of investment and speculative investment. This is how we make money with capital. Against buying at a low price from one who needs money so badly that he or she sells low and selling again at a high price. He says, trading companies are a bottomless pit of avarice and wrongdoing. They control all the commodities. One of the things we've talked about lately is seed companies controlling seeds so much that South Dakota farmers lose their farms because the seed prices are controlled by just a few companies and they buy so low that the South Dakota farmers can't make enough money to keep their farms going. But I'm interrupting Luther here. Trading companies control all commodities, raise or lower prices at their pleasure. They oppress and ruin all the small businessmen. Through their practices, all the world must be sucked dry and all the money sink and swim in their gullets. I want to talk about some of the interesting coherences between these norms and today, but I want to say two things first. And one we'll talk about in more depth later in the hour. And that is that I am not claiming that we should just take Luther's norms and apply them today. That would be a grand mistake. Luther said some horrible things in his life. And you can't just uncritically take his moral norms and say, we'll live with them today. He advocated burning synagogues and horrible things against Jews and the Radical Reformation. So I'm not saying we have to take what he says and apply it today. I am saying that we ought look at the theological underpinnings of these norms and where those theological underpinnings are consistent with what we hold to be true in Luther, we need to take that seriously. And the theological underpinning of Luther's economic norms is one thing with two facets. It is neighbor love. We are bound, we are obligated in every aspect of our life, including economic life, to serve the neighbor. And the other dimension of neighbor love is that we are, as believers, filled with Christ, and the love of Christ becomes real in us and loves others and empowers us to love, including in our economic lives. Those are the theological underpinnings of his radical economic norms. Some of the norms that he establishes, and I won't give all the detail on this, pertain only to Christians. And the reason is that Christians have this power to love, so they have more stringent economic norms. To demonstrate for you through his voice this underpinning of neighbor love that is the foundation of his economic ethics, I will simply read to you one little quote from Luther. And he is talking about people's resources, the resources that people own for making a living. In his day and age, that was tools and things like that. In our day and age, we have a broader expanse of resources. It might be education, it might be whatever, property, whatever we have. But he's speaking about our resources, and he says, all of these resources are continually, I quote now, continually crying out to you, friend, use me in relation to your neighbor, just as you would want your neighbor to use his property in relation with you. But we are like vipers which stop up their ears and become deaf when someone tries to trap them. We refuse to see or hear what is inscribed in our own hearts and thoughts, and we plunge in recklessly. Ha, we say, I may do business with my possessions as I please and sell them for as much as I can get for them. Who is going to stop me? That is what Squire Skinflint and Squire Squeeze do at the market. Maybe we're talking to your question here, Sue. I go on with Luther. But we are not preaching to such people, and neither is Christ. He wants nothing to do with them and despises them as much as they do him. He will let them go to the devil so that he and they will have nothing further to do with each other. Now, unquote. I am not saying that Skinflints and Squint and whatever are going to the devil. I am reading what Luther is saying about what we are to do with our resources. And it's distinctly different from making a profit off of people. It has to do with, as he said, friend, use these in relation to your neighbor, as you would want your neighbor to use his possessions in relation to you. Economic life as embodiment of neighbor love transgressed the emerging economic order of Luther's day. And I think it's fascinating to note some of the ways in which it transgresses the economic practices and norms of our day. Perhaps we could take just a minute to identify places that you see some coherence between the ways in which, between his norms, or some contradictions between his norms and the economic practices inherent in globalization today. Remember, his norms were buying and selling is an act towards neighbor, so the goal isn't profit, but service to neighbor. Economic activity ought to be subject to political constraints. Don't trade or don't focus trade on ostentatious items. Do you see some of the ways in which they resonate with what we've been talking about the global economy today? Or our own particular, our personal economic lives today? The one about buying and selling, selling something at as high a price as the market can bear. Someone brought up in another discussion we were having in one of these sessions the way we sell a house in Seattle today. The guiding norm for selling a house in Seattle is you get the most you can get for it, because you can get a lot. And you sell your house, you put your house on the market, and people come in over the selling price, and then you choose the highest of those. But do we ever put thought into it about who's being served or not served, the needs of people? To me, that was a kind of mini example of a resonance, a consonance. Any other thoughts where you see Luther's norms maybe standing in contradiction to our norms of economic practice?
Well, it's like I've said earlier, I'm always appalled when the stockholders are always the most important thing, and And so when we talk about profit in a company, we talk about profit based on, oh, we just fired another 300 people, so therefore we can increase the profit of the company and give X number of more dollars to the shareholders. Now, what about those 300 people that just got knocked off?
Okay. That's a beautiful example, because it involves any of us who have money in a mutual fund. Because what we want is, normally, what we want is the best gain on the investment. But you're right. The notion that buying and selling is geared primarily at the well-being of neighbor would challenge our placing that profit motive in investments as the highest criterion, wouldn't it? Good example.
Yeah. The profit many times, though, is just a cover, because that same executive may walk off with a $30 or $40 million parachute. They can fire him because he did a terrible job in running the corporation, and they hand him $30 million. They take it out of the pensions of the workers, and they've used that up. But the profit is just a cover for their own greed.
Okay, so that's a nuance to that. And then, yeah, very good. You had your hand up, sir.
Well, we were just in California. Our son-in-law's father was talking about how incredibly the housing prices have risen and risen to millions of dollars. What used to be $50,000 home or $100,000 are now in the millions. That the blue collar workers and ordinary people and young people cannot afford to buy these homes, and they have to live out 50, 60 to 100 miles and commute in because they can't afford to live in this.
That's a perfect example of and it demonstrates how we're all a part of it in a certain sense. If I own a home in Seattle, a one voice in me is delighted that housing prices are going up. My equity is going up. But am I thinking about the well-being of the vulnerable? And in economic life, Luther means different things with neighbor in different writings, but in economic life, neighbor is usually the vulnerable, the needy. Am I thinking about the needy, those people who have to live 100 miles out? Am I thinking, again, in Seattle, I heard on public radio the other day that increasingly teachers in Seattle, public school teachers, can't live in Seattle. If they're coming in, they have to live like an hour and a half commute out. So to get to teach, if you have to be at your school at 7:15 in the morning, you have to leave your house at, what would that be, 5:45? You've got your own kids to take care of. And it's because housing prices have gone up. Now, how many of us public citizens in Seattle, homeowners, have said, we've got to think together in a political, meaning the body politic way, to keep this from happening? How many of us would say that when we stand to gain by the housing prices going up? I think that's kind of an example of, is economic life oriented at maximizing my profit, or is economic life oriented at a sustainable community in which the needs of the vulnerable are met? So thank you for that example also. Yeah. Others, ma'am.
Well, what are we teaching our children at school? I mean, you have to be successful and you have to earn a good income. So we're teaching our children to look at money as what's measuring your worth, instead of looking at your community, your job, to be successful.
A profound example, and that goes back to what we talked about around belief systems. The belief system that somehow your money measures your worth is somewhat insidious and present. But if our children were taught that their gifts, the gifts that they have, their intellect, their energy, their education, their upbringing in a healthy home, are to be used in service, that's a different kind of economic life that they'll live than if they're taught that the more money they make, the prouder we'll sort of be about them, and we can say my son or daughter is a, that's a very good example of formation into this. I claim that we're malformed, that we have become a malformed people, malformed into ways of injustice, and we need to be reformed in good Lutheran terminology. Oh, thank you. Yes?
Struck by the, when a product or like a crop is in a low supply, mm-hmm. that that according to Luther, the prices shouldn't be raised.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That definitely puts people before profit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you want everyone to still be able to have some food. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who afford it.
Mm-hmm. Right. It really defies one of the principles of capitalism, that right, good point, good example.
I heard a survey, and I'm not just sure with how the data, but it went something like this: asking young people what they're going to do at graduation. Now we just went through graduation. Many of them are going to college. Why are you going to college?
Oh,
to make money.
Really? Well, so thank you. What have we done as a society to our young people if that is the goal of their life?
Yeah, that's right. And that, that was the kind of thing, the numbers, they gave numbers, and I don't remember, but the percentage of young people going to college, and the answer is why they're going. It's to make money.
Interesting. You know, in the midst of this, I think it's also, in light of that comment, and in light of all it, how much it implicates us as a society, I think it's also important to hold up the ways in which, even unknowingly, we have resisted that kind of dynamic in our society. And I think that the Lutheran tradition, for all I would critique it for being thoroughly passive in the face of economic injustice, I would like to pull out a beautiful strain in the Lutheran tradition. I think that historically, the Lutheran tradition has nurtured teachers and preachers, has encouraged people to teach and preach. And that is certainly not to go out and make money. And so I think that that's an important thing to hold up in our own tradition, a little grain of something to hold up. But your point, if we're raising children to believe that the aim of their economic life, the use of their resources in society, is to make money, then that is... maybe that's part of the answer to your question, Sue, why someone would buy the water supply and raise the cost. Paula?
We touched briefly last night on the family and the role. You were kind of leaning toward that. My question is, beginning on, at the family level, I know in the volunteer work that I do, I'm exposed to a lot of young people that haven't a clue how to establish a family, let alone have the value system within themselves. So how can we, you're asking questions on a much broader basis. I'm coming back to what I feel somehow, and I don't have a clue how to start it, but somehow the families, if we can get the families back on base. We're short on pastors, and I understand there's more congregations calling pastors than there are pastors to go around. So where do we start? My personal feeling is somehow it's got to start at the lay level.
Well, and you raise a good point, Paula. You say I'm it's true, I'm giving examples in the more public level, maybe rather than the private level, and it makes me want to say something that I'm firmly convinced of, and that is our response to this this situation, which, as you know, I feel is quite dramatic, needs to be on multiple levels. It has to do with our private lives, our private use of our resources. And it has to do with our public lives. To be a person of faith, at least in this tradition that we're discussing now, that Luther is laying out for us, is to be a public citizen, to look at how, as corporate bodies, as church bodies, as neighborhood bodies, as citizens, electorate, we can give shape to our public life. So I do believe that in our individual economic lives and in our role, in our claiming a role in public life, that both of these are integral to our response as people of faith to the globalizing economy as it plays out in our own little neighborhoods. I want to read just one more quote from Luther, because I really was bowled over when I started reading this stuff, because I've been talking about the problem as free, meaning deregulated, liberalized markets and trade and investment. And he says in one document, he names the free public market. He's talking about the free market in his day. Excuse me. He says about the free public market, daily the poor are defrauded. New burdens and high prices are imposed. Think of our housing. Everyone misuses the market in his own willful, conceited, and arrogant way, as if it were his right and privilege to sell his goods as dearly as he pleases. Public officials should establish and maintain order in all areas of trade and commerce in order that the poor may not be burdened and oppressed. So this points again to undoing the subordination of public officials, of democratic political power, as the body politic and as public officials, and raising it from a subordinated position to having an impact in regulating economic life. That is kind of what I read in Luther at that point. We only have a few other minutes left.
Where does...
So I want to think about where we're going here. Okay, questions. Mark.
When you were mentioning the water, the other point that I struck me was the water rights.
Mm.
And that those water rights also are both globally and locally.
Mm.
And especially dealing with dam issues in Northwest, North America, South America, and the water rights of our oceans even.
Mm. Mm. So that really brings in the question of rights of life forms that aren't just human forms.
And the ecology of the life forms of those areas of water rights.
Good point. And today we need to push our notions that way and think about rights of other life forms. You had a question too, sir.
I was going to ask what particular books or articles did you glean these from Luther, of Luther's?
Okay, I gleaned them from various articles and books, and I'll say some specific ones. And I'll first say that his economic ethics are all wrapped up with his Eucharistic theology, his theology of the Eucharist. And some of his profound writings about economic life are in his writings about the Eucharist. And that is part of what we'll talk about tomorrow. In terms of specific documents that these citations came from, maybe what I should let you do is just look over my footnotes here. Would that be the way to go, or shall I take time to look them up right now?
No, that'd be fine.
Okay, let me hand you my footnotes afterwards. I'll tell you that most of it, I'll just name it, and for the purpose of the tape too, the document called Trade and Usury, the document, which is 1924, I think, the document called Admonition to Preachers to Preach Against Usury, and another document, and the name slips my mind, that also has trade and usury in it, are the three main documents in economic life. But if you read in the catechisms his writings about the Ten Commandments and the Lord's Prayer, you encounter a lot of it. And then if you read in his Eucharistic writings, particularly the holy and true body and blood of Jesus Christ, that's one. And there's another one that is the confession concerning the body and blood of Jesus Christ. I'm not giving you the exact name correctly, but you can find it with that. And afterward, you can look in my endnotes. Both of those documents are in Timothy Lull's anthology of Luther's writings that is a tremendous anthology that I recommend to everyone. It's a one book, about yay thick. The editor is Lull, L-U-L-L, the president of PLTS. And it's a great anthology, just read it. And the two documents that I mentioned concerning the Eucharist are in that book.
In the library.
Oh, is it in the library? You're right, it is in the library. It's a good place to start. Well, again, I do want to maybe close with two things. One is, don't read me as saying that whatever Luther said about his day, we do today. Because my tactic is more to say, what is underpinning these norms of Luther? And how does that underpinning give validity to those norms or take it away? For instance, his norms about brutalizing Jews was a very different norm that we can't claim. The norm of neighbor love is fundamental to his theology. His theology doesn't stand without, he says, the two principles of Christian doctrine are this, and one of them is that Jesus Christ died to save us from our sins, et cetera, et cetera, and the other is love. Love for neighbor. And that is in, I think that's in Two Kinds of Righteousness. So that is the theological underpinning. And what we take away, what I suggest we take away, is if we take seriously that economic life is governed by one principle, love of neighbor, then we have to rethink our economic lives. Now, there's a nuance to that for Luther, and it's a lovely nuance to me as a feminist, because as a feminist, I can't claim validity in serving others without also honoring the needs of self. Women have been forced to serve others without honoring the needs of self for centuries. So I said to Luther, when I encountered that, he has statements that say, your all of your actions and all of your thoughts and deeds should only serve the needs of the other. And I thought, wait a minute, Luther, what about women who have never ever met their own needs? Historically, I'm saying. So I read deeper, and I found that when he writes about economic life, he really also says, meet the needs of your family. Meet their needs. He's very vehement about not going beyond their needs, but meet the needs of the family, the viable needs of the family, and then beyond that, serve the well-being of all. So he's not saying just go and dump yourself in a ditch and don't acknowledge the fact that you and your family need food and shelter and clothing, but he's saying provide the food and shelter and clothing and education for your family, and then your resources are calling out to you, friend, use me for your neighbor. So that's the main thing I want to close with. And the second thing is that in terms of tomorrow, I would say this. If we claim that economic life as we know it now is exploitative in general, and if we claim that there are alternatives, we must somehow, by the power of God, have the power, the spiritual power, to move towards those alternatives. And when I asked Luther, where is that spiritual power found? One of the answers he says is in the Eucharist, in the celebration of the body and blood of Christ. And that's part of what we're going to look at tomorrow, the role of the Eucharist in economic justice. And also we're going to look at some principles undergirding alternatives to economic globalization as defined by these trends and as we know it today. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow. Thank you all for your participation in this, and the tapers may end the tape.